Today's program is brought to you by the Dairy Farm Families of Wisconsin, the Wisconsin Milk Marketing Board. Did you know that today Wisconsin produces more than 600 varieties, types, and styles of American, international style, and original cheese that win more awards than any other state or country? To learn more, visit eatwisconsincheese.com.
You're listening to Heritage Radio Network. We're a member-supported food radio network, broadcasting over 35 weekly shows live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. Join our hosts as they lead you through the world of craft brewing, behind the scenes of the restaurant industry, inside the battle over school food, and beyond. Find us at heritageradionetwork.org.
Good evening and welcome to
Fun Men About It
on HeritageRadioNetwork.org.
I'm Mary Izett.
I'm Chris Kuzmi.
And I'm Rachel Jacobs.
And we're your host on this weekly journey of all things fermented.
Archived on Stitcher, iTunes, and right here on HeritageRadioNetwork.org. Welcome to episode 192. That's crazy to me.
We are slowly approaching episode 200.
I've been thinking a lot about time because I'm just entering my fourth decade. Hey, thank you very much. Thank you very much. Good times. I'm only going to drink cask ale and barley wines here on out and drink old man beers. I like them flat, warm, and naturally carbonated.
You're actually entering your fifth decade, though.
Well, see, that's how good at math that these years have taught me.
Just saying, technically, 0 through 9 counts.
Fine.
We're good. Even more so.
Good, so I have to go back to carbonated beverages. I'm happy about that because there's lots of fun carbonated beverage-oriented things coming up. New York City Beer Week is happening on February 24th until March 5th, and we're really, really excited. There's going to be an insane amount of stuff happening here in New York City, starting with something we're heavily involved in. The catalyst for getting New York City's first fermentation festival together has been our opening bash for New York City Beer Week. We had the space, the venue, and now we have an incredible lineup of fermenters and panelists and seminars on February 25th. If you go to nycfermentationfestival.com, you can find out more information, and we'll talk a little bit about more stuff that's going on with that throughout this episode.
And tickets are available now?
Tickets
online?
Are available now online. They were briefly not available last night, apparently, because there was some default thing, but I fixed it.
Technical glitch.
So much
technical
traffic,
glitch.
Right?
Yeah. Exactly.
So I am doing a series of mending workshops here in New York City, and the first two are actually at brewers, so they have some relevance. I'm going to do one tomorrow night at Rockaway Brewing Company. It is free. It'll be from 7 to 9 or so, so feel free to come on by. And then the second one will be on the 22nd at Strong Rope in Gowanus. So basically, it's a free mending workshop. We're going to do everything from how to sew on buttons to visible mending to invisible mending.
That sounds
craft paired with craft beer.
Yes. Speaking of craft, so I actually have a one of my friends back in August. We did an episode about Pruno or prison wine. It was episode 173, and we had a question about why do Pruno recipes usually call for some ketchup? Like, it doesn't seem to add anything, and it's kind of gross. But a friend of mine who is also a brewer. Offered an explanation, which is that the vinegar in the ketchup can help make the Pruno acidic enough to keep botulism out.
Ah. Plus, and the ketchup does add sugar.
Yeah.
Yeah, but so probably sugar also adds sugar.
Yeah.
Right. That's fair. Smarty pants. Smarty pants over there. Sugar adds sugar. Okay. Also, Homebrew Rally 11 is happening. We've been hosting this at the New York City Homebrewers Guild. We're really excited to host it again at Alewife. I think the registration is closed. We did our bottle sorting last week, but we still can use your palate. If you're a BJCP HA sanctioned judge or a pro brewer and you have a palate to lend, go to homebrewalley.com to sign up. If you are not a judge and you'd like to experience the behind the scenes of a large homebrew competition, you can steward and help the judges, help serve the judges these homebrews and pour.
And then there will be an after party.
There will be an after party
ceremony. That's open to all.
That's right. And we will kind of blindly taste with the public some of the entries that were not judged. And then speaking of judging in homebrew, which is the largest homebrew competition in the world, is happening, the National Homebrew Competition, and we are hosting the first round at Kings County Brewers Collective. So if you go to AmericasHomebrewersAssociation.com and find out where you can sign up to, for your local region. Basically, we'll do it in 11 or 12 different cities around the country. But here in New York, we'll do it at Kings County's Brewers Collective on March 24th and 25th. And we still need judges and stewards, and that brings us to today's episode. Mary, I'm leaving this to you.
All right. So back last year when we drove up to Boston for the Boston Fermentation Festival, we met a lot of people, some of which we had the opportunity to interview there, and then we've had a couple people in studio. So Adam Elabd is our guest today. We met you at the Boston Fermentation Festival. You gave a seminar. I know you made Tepache, and that came around the same time or shortly thereafter that your book came out called Fermenting Food Step by Step. So it was awesome going to your seminar and meeting you, and we bought the book when we were up there. Welcome to the studio.
Thank you.
Elabd.
So let's start how you got into fermentation.
It actually came about, I guess sometime in 2010, 2011, I started getting interested in herbalism and herbal medicine and natural medicine. And very quickly, I was living up in Oregon on this farm that grows organic herbs for making medicinal extracts with, and doing like a herbiculture internship, and just learning more about herbs and medicine, food as medicine, and then you very quickly, fermented foods start to come up as like the heavy hitters of health and nutrition and healing and gut healing, and also a whole host of all the other benefits, which I'm sure your listeners are well-versed at now from y'all getting into it. And so it just got me excited. I started my first batch of kimchi and my first cider while I was sort of traveling up and down the Pacific Northwest in my car, and it was like November at the time, so I would bring the cider in to wherever I was staying with friends. I'd like bring it in at night and keep it warm, and then during the day I'd get back in my car and I'd put it in the back seat and sort of like try to keep it upright, and same thing with the kimchi, and just started falling in love with the process even before I had a home to homestead in. And from there it was just one thing led to another, and I started making more and more things and teaching people how to do it. And yeah, that's
sort what of were the, some of those early ferments like that you traveled with, and how have you improved on your process? Are you still fermenting in the middle of your car and then bringing it into places?
It's funny because yeah, there's actually a jar of miso right now.
Actually,
from last night, my wife and I went to Cheryl Passwater's miso workshop at Honey's, and so we made some black-eyed pea miso, and yeah, it's definitely in the back of the truck right now, probably way too chilly. But yeah, and there's like tepache and this kombucha that we're sipping on right here, bottle conditioning in the back of the truck as well. So I think that somehow has managed to still hold. But yeah, those early ferments, I remember like the kimchi, I was stoked about making this super medicinal kimchi. And so I put garlic and turmeric and ginger and horseradish and onion and all different kinds of chili peppers, and I maxed it out so much in all of these antibacterial, antimicrobial herbs and medicine that, and I put galangal in it. I mean, it was just like everything I could do. And it just didn't do anything.
Too many preservatives.
A month later, I was like, is this like the day I put it in the jar. It's exactly the same. It was good medicine, but it was barely fermented. So yeah, things have definitely developed a lot since then.
And so now you are in Troy, New York.
Right.
So how did you make your way out? How'd you end up in Troy?
So yeah.
So Troy, New York is upstate, very close to Albany, the state capital.
Right.
Of
New
York.
10, 15 minutes north of Albany. And my wife and I moved out from California. We were sort of, we'd been living in Long Beach, which was a really cool place to live for a couple years. A lot of really awesome small businesses, and actually friends of ours who were making fermented foods and selling it and rocking it, making kombucha, making sauerkrauts, making all kinds of stuff. And it was a great place, but we were looking to move somewhere a little bit with a little bit more space and a little bit more opportunity to actually lay down some roots and make something happen. And Southern California is so expensive, and trying to do anything, the regulations are really intense. And we were just ready for a change. So we have some family out here from my mom's side in upstate New York, and things kind of just materialized where we were leaving California. We went traveling for a little bit, trying to figure out where to go next. And then magnetism just brought us to upstate New York, and we were going to check it out for a while and see what's up. And Troy turned out to be this really hip place. My wife's a potter, and she's been working out of a pottery studio there. There's a really awesome art community. There's some really cool stuff happening with food and breweries popping up and different fermented beverages and stuff happening. So it was just somewhere that we naturally ended up sort of starting to get involved in, and it's been good. And it's been awesome to be 3 hours from here, 3 hours from Boston, 3 hours from Montreal.
Yeah.
So kind of getting the crash course in the Northeast.
Yeah, everything in the Northeast is not too far away for the most part.
Compared to California, where it's like, oh, let's go to San Francisco, 7 hour drive. You know, here it's like there's so much we can see within a day trip. So it's awesome.
Yeah.
What inspired you to write a book and share your knowledge here?
So that was kind of a far out experience, because the way that it worked, I had been working on like little booklets and sort of like zine style recipe books to give to students or to just have available, because I was teaching all around Southern California from San Diego all the way up to Santa Barbara, which is like about a 5 hour distance from one to the other, and then all the way into Riverside and the Inland Empire. And so I was driving all around and teaching, and that was awesome, and I was loving that. And then I just kind of out of the blue got contacted by DK, this publishing company, and they wanted to do a book on fermentation, and they were looking for people who teach fermentation, even if they weren't, you know, established authors, to do the authoring and, you know, write all the recipes and all that for the book. And so I went through this process with them where they're like, all right, but we want you to have it all done in 2 months. And I was like, all right. I had about like 20 to 25 recipes already written that I was giving, you know, in classes and handouts and stuff like that. But they wanted like 85 to 90. And so I got to work. Luckily, we were living in Long Beach. Like I said, I had like this community of friends, like an amazing sourdough baker, Arturo of Emilu Cob Oven. He was really rocking it with the sourdough. So he sort of coached me really quickly through that process. And we had friends that were at Anandamide Psychedelicatessen that were making chocolate, but also coconut kefir and a lot of other different sort of more far out ferments, as well as sauerkraut. And so I had a lot of people to sort of reach out to and sort of collaborate with on some of the recipes and content, and just put everything off, stop doing anything other than just making. Our fridge was completely overflowing. We had to have a couple dinners where we just had people over to just eat all these things that most of them had never even heard of, but they were all really good sports. And and so that's how the book kind of came to be and came together.
I really enjoyed your talk up at the Boston Fermentation Festival, and you made a tepache there, and you also talked about kind of traditional tepache and pulque and your experiences in Mexico. Could you talk a little bit about that? First of all, tell us what both of those are really quick.
Right. So my talk was on Mexican, I think I called it tepache and friends. So Mexican fermented beverages. I showed people how to make tepache, because it's like a really accessible, easy to start with fermented beverage. I think it's one of the easiest. And so that's made with, tepache is made with the rind and the core of the pineapple, along with piloncillo, which is an unrefined cane sugar, and cinnamon, clove, allspice, whatever spices you want to put, and then water. And the wild yeast from the pineapple rind gets things going, and it makes this bubbly, slightly alcoholic, but mostly just super vital and delicious fermented beverage with some zing to it. And pulque is made with aguamiel, which is the sap of the agave plant, or maguey, as it's more often called. And so they take the aguamiel, which is the sap, by cutting off the top of it. They collect that, and you can drink that straight or ferment it into pulque. And it has this very sort of like, if you've messed with aloe juice before, that like kind of slimy, mucilaginous consistency.
Even after fermenting, it's
even after fermenting, yeah, for sure. And it's I was enamored with it for a long time without even trying it, and then got to visit Mexico City briefly while visiting my mother-in-law's area of Mexico in Guerrero in the south. And we took a pilgrimage to Mexico City and had pulque there in a pulqueria. And yeah, they serve it out of barrels, and it's super alive, super delicious. It's like a meal, and it's amazing. And it definitely, it's probably like 2-4% alcohol, but so it creeps up on you, but then then it gets you.
And they had two flavors of...
Right, so the one we went to, they had avena, which is oat. They had guava. And the guava, he was like, oh, this has been sitting around for a couple days extra, so it was, like, extra strong.
So that's so what is the typical ferment time for both a tepache and a pulque?
So tepache, you make it at home in a jar. It's definitely drinkable and rocking within 2 to 3 days. I've aged it for longer. I've aged it up to a month. 2 months. I have some with hops that I'm aging a little bit longer too. I've just been playing around with it. But typically it's made, it ferments quickly, and it's served out of barrels, sort of like on roadsides or in marketplaces. I learned, so going back to the part you were asking about like where I kind of learned about these and my relationship with them. Living in Southern California, Mexico is really close, and we would drive to Mexicali to visit my wife's family, and we drive to Tijuana to go visit friends down there and check out the art scene. And so I got to have tepache early on down in Tijuana. And it could have all different other kinds of fruits in it. And usually it's in this barrel that's like painted all dopely. And they'll serve it right out. And it's carbonated only because it's still actively fermenting. It's not under any kind of pressure or enclosed in any way. So you can only imagine that like it has to be drank pretty young, because it'll burn through the sugar within a week for sure, and at that point it won't be carbonated anymore. So it's something that's drank fresh more. And so is pulque. Pulque, it's like, I think a week is pretty much they like bring it from the countryside around Mexico City. They'll bring in the aguamiel, and they'll ferment it in barrels, and then they'll take that and kind of like, if you've ever flavored kombucha, you do this like secondary fermentation or this secondary steep. So you'll take the pulque as it's still really young, and then infuse it with oats, or we had one with peanut that was amazing.
Interesting.
Yeah. Guava, any number of fruits. There was sarsamora, which is like a blackberry. You could do anything. But then it's still, like, it has to be drank within 2 to 3 days from their perspective. Otherwise, it gets kind of acidic and more alcoholic, which I was down with. But
and more funky.
Yeah, definitely funky, for sure.
Yeah, because tepache, I've made tepache, and I have a recipe in my book, but it has added, I usually add yeast you can get a cleaner, more alcoholic, but tepache, but you can use, like you mentioned, you could use other fruit scraps. Like if you were making a fruit salad, you could use, you know, when you're peeling apples or whatever, even use like a little bit of citrus zest, anything, you know, it's kind of a good way to use your comp, you know, your fruit comp.
For sure. And that's really something that I've been, and that's something that I've really been focusing on a lot throughout this process, but more and more recently as I'm thinking about doing some of these ferments on a larger scale, is it's all fermentation at its core is a preservation technique, right? And it happens to make things more delicious as well. But it's always sad to me to see fermentation processes that also create a lot of waste. And so when you're able to make use of the part that you would normally throw away, which tepache is an amazing example of that because it's inedible. You can't eat the rind of the pineapple as far as I know. And you can kind of gnaw at the core, but it's really fibrous and tough. So to be able to use it to make this beverage, which you can actually, and you can re-ferment the same rind and core for a second and third batch, you're getting so much out of the part that you would throw away. And so, and that's kind of what I'm going to be talking about at the New York City Fermentation Festival.
Yeah, Justin!
Which is sort of synergistic ferments for
sustainability.
Right, for sustainable preservation, which is that, like, if you're making kombucha, especially if you're making, you know, many gallons of it, but even if you're just making a little bit, there's all those tea leaves. And there's places in Asia and China, and mostly I've heard about it in China, where they'll, like, saute the tea leaves or fry them up. If you're using Lipton tea bags to make your kombucha, you're not really, there's already waste from the tea bag and the tea is cut very fine, so it's essentially useless. But if you're using a nice loose leaf, whole tea leaf, then you can take that and you can just saute it or fry it up and eat it straight, or you can make La Pet with it, which is a ferment that I got turned onto when I was sort of researching for the book. It's from Myanmar, or also known as Burma, and they take tea leaves. And the method for making La Pet it was funny to me reading it, because you take the tea leaves, you put them in hot water, and soak them, and then you dump out that water, and then you do it again overnight, and then you dump out that water, and then you take the tea leaves, and once you've leached most of the tannins out, and then mix it with garlic and lemon and sesame oil and salt and ferment them like that. So I'm like, oh, so in order to make La Pet, you have to make a bunch of tea, basically, and pour it out. It's like the same process for making something like kombucha, but what's considered waste in one process is different than what's considered waste in the other. So whenever I make kombucha, I make a point to get really nice tea leaves that aren't very stemmy that I know are going to also make a good La Pet. Mm-hmm. Or like with ginger beer, I'll boil the same ginger 2-3 times because you can get, ginger keeps giving, yeah. Right? And when I was learning about gari, which is the pickled ginger that comes with, you see it at like sushi spots and stuff, although it's typically not pink, you can put shiso leaves and get a little bit of color in there, but... So the process for making gari is you finely slice the ginger, you boil it once, you pour out that water, you boil it again, you pour that out again to really like take a lot of the bite out of the ginger, and then you pickle it. So it's a no-brainer to me. Like if I'm making ginger beer, I'll go through the little bit of extra effort to slice the ginger nice and fine so that after I'm done getting my strong ginger infusion for the ginger beer, then I've also got all this ginger that I can pickle and make gari with. So that's really what I've been trying to bring into a lot of my fermentation work, is how can I create, and I feel like the term like zero waste can kind of get taken a little bit too far and turn into this like very hard-nosed sort of like cultish thing where I'm not trying to like make this really intense political statement, right. Although there are really intense political statements that need to be made. But I'm trying to get the best ginger to make my ginger beer. I don't want to throw, or the best tea to make my kombuchas. I don't want to be throwing all that away. If I could find a way to make use of it, then that's honoring the ingredients and the work that went into them. And especially in upstate New York now, we're surrounded by these amazing producers. I mean, the farmers markets in like little towns are so much more amazing to me than the massive farmers markets in Southern California that we used to go to. And we will go to farms and visit the people and like get things directly from them. And it's been awesome. But even more so, it's like, okay, I just like got these like carrots that were grown on this farm where they're raising the animals and using the manure to nourish the soil, and they're like putting their heart and soul into it, and everything is so wholesome that I'm looking at these carrots like, I don't want to throw any of this away. I'm not peeling. I never peel vegetables anyways, but...
Like, which is good. Most of the vitamins are often some on the outside anyway.
Right.
The outside layers are
concentrated. And so even more so, I feel like, wow, it's like an honor. It's like you're receiving like a sacrament from these producers. And so really to do everything possible to honor that and create more delicious stuff for all of us to enjoy.
Right on. We are going to take a really quick break. Thanks for listening to Foment About It with Enemy Labbed.
Today's program is brought to you by the Wisconsin Milk Marketing Board. Wisconsin produces the world's best cheese, period. Why? Lush grasslands, glacial water supply, fourth generation cheesemakers, combining old world tradition with the new ideas and highest standards. The very best milk. What do you think of when you think of Wisconsin cheese? For me, I think cheese curds, delicious fresh cheese curds, or deep fried cheese curds. Cheese curds literally any way, anytime, any place. I think about Andy Hatch and Upland's Cheese Company, the operation behind the Pleasant Ridge Reserve cheese that's literally America's most awarded cheese. I think of the deliciously stinky Limburger and its long-storied history. I think about Raleigh's Dumbarton Blue, a perfect blend of English-style cheddar and notes of blue. I think of Emmy Roth's Grand Cru Sirchois, which was named 2016's World Champion at the World Championship Cheese Contest. Wisconsin is like the world champion of cheese, and once you start reading the list of cheeses made in Wisconsin on their website, you can see why. The Wisconsin Milk Marketing Board is a nonprofit organization funded entirely by Wisconsin's dairy farm families. Read more at eatwisconsincheese.com, and as soon as you're done listening to this podcast, eat Wisconsin cheese. It's a no-brainer.
Welcome back to episode 192 of Men About It on HeritageRadioNetwork.org. And we are here in the studio with Adam Elabd, author of Fermenting Food Step by Step and one of the featured seminar speakers for the New York City Fermentation Festival. He's going to talk about synergistic ferments for preserving sustainability, which we were just talking about, or synergistic. We were just talking about this before the break, and you also just served us a kombucha. Tell us about this beverage.
So this kombucha is made with a black tea from India called Nilgiri Blue, and I've been working a lot with saffron recently because I grew up in Saudi Arabia, and I'm half Egyptian, so saffron is something that is sort of one of the keystone, I think, spices used, especially in Saudi Arabian cuisine. And I'm always working with it at home, and just decided to make a little kombucha. It's actually just this bottle right here that I was like, oh, I'll put some saffron in this.
Where are you sourcing your saffron?
So this saffron I actually got the last time I went and visited my parents out there several years ago, and it's from Iran. But since then, I've had really good saffron from Italy, from some friends that we have out there that are growing it biodynamically in the Italian countryside in the state of Abruzzo. And then I've had some from Greece that was really good. There's saffron growing in Spain that's awesome.
Have you worked with it a lot, and do you have any tricks to using saffron or favorite?
Actually, that's a good question, because it's so expensive.
Yeah.
And so
how do you maximize?
Exactly. Yeah. And it's sad when you try to use it, and like if you're making rice and if you look to recipes and places where they use saffron, you'll see these techniques. If you're making rice, you don't like put some saffron threads in the pot of rice while you're boiling it. You're not going to get much out of it that way. And you lose a lot of the aroma as well. So typically what people will do is and I do this with a small jar at home, like an 8-ounce jar. I'll put 10 to 20 threads, saffron threads in the jar, and then some warm water. And then you let that sit for 5, 10, 15 minutes. And it just creates an infusion. And that way the saffron really has the opportunity to release all that it has to release.
When you say warm water...
Yeah, so not like straight up boiling, like the type of water you would use to make a green tea, like somewhere in the 170 range. Or it could just be room temperature and leave it for a little bit longer. But if the water's a little bit warm, it extracts better. And then you can keep that jar of saffron water in the fridge and use it over the course of 3 to 5 days before it starts to kind of turn. And so that's what I did here. I just had some saffron water and I just put a tablespoon of it in the bottle before bottling the kombucha. And if you're wanting to make saffron rice, a lot of times like Iranian recipes will tell you to make the rice and then have some saffron water. And then after the rice is cooked, add that and mix it in. Mm-hmm. And then you get more of the color and the aroma and the flavor.
That makes sense. Yeah. So what I want, I'm going to have you actually start pouring the tepache. Mm-hmm. Now, so these are in really nice bottles. You have labels.
Right.
And they're part of your project that you have coming up. So talk a little bit about that.
Right. So we're right now in the thick of opening a cafe and tonic bar in upstate New York in the city of Troy. And it's going to be a place where you can go eat. And we're going to have all kinds of fermented foods. We'll be making yogurt in-house with heirloom yogurt starter and then making our parfaits with that and making other dishes with it. And basically everything as much as possible from scratch, starting with as many local ingredients as we can get our hands on and use, and which luckily up there is a lot. There's a lot available. And also because my wife and I both have backgrounds in herbalism, like I was saying, that's kind of what took me to fermentation. Sort of the idea of people being able to come in and have a drink, and maybe it's a cocktail, but it's a cocktail made with some kind of a local spirit, and then bitters that specifically have, you know, that have more of a focus and a lean towards the medicinal aspects. And like, where do bitters come from? Where does the whiskey bitters come from? That comes from the very earliest cocktail culture and bartending, where you'd go in and tell the bartender what ails you and he would make something for you. And so trying to bring that back in, not as much in terms of like really being like a craft cocktail bar, but more being a place where we've got all kinds of tonics. You can come in and get kombucha or tepache or any number of kefirs, like water kefir style kefirs on draft, kvass, and then also syrups and elixirs and tinctures and other kinds of herbal extracts that we're going to combine in hopefully exciting ways. Exciting to us and hopefully to everybody else too, so that you can go in and have something delicious and exciting that also makes you feel good, because that's something that sadly seems to be missing from the like whole exciting foodie scene that's blowing up everywhere, as people want to know more about the ingredients and the quality of ingredients. And this whole farm-to-table, farm-to-fork, all this. But then a lot of times you see these beautiful farm-fresh, organic, biodynamic, everything to the max, right, as clean as you can get ingredients. And then it's like deep-fried, or it's like prepared in a way that's just, number one, to me, like kind of going back to what I was saying, it doesn't really honor the ingredients. And also, it doesn't make you feel good. And so what's the point, you know? Short of being like a health food spot, which has its own sort of stigma and all that, I just want to make things that are exciting and delicious, mm-hmm, using traditional techniques. So we're going to be like, if you eat a bean in our spot, and if you come to Tonico and eat beans, they're going to be soaked overnight and then boiled, cooked in clay pots, slow cooked, in traditional Mexican earthenware bean pots. If you have rice, we're going to be making rice in the donabe, which is a Japanese earthenware clay pot. Really trying to like cook with the elements, cook with fire, use clay, use traditional materials, and show people how really, like, what I like to say is like how great granny or great grandpappy mm-hmm. used to cook, right? A lot of people, even their grandparents, weren't using traditional methods anymore. We're several generations removed. Some people are still living in parts of, like, where I'm from in Egypt. There's a lot of people living in the countryside still doing things old school. But more and more we're seeing that, especially in urban centers, we're like 2 to 3 to 4 generations removed from the way that people used to live and eat and cook in synergy with the land and with their environment. And so that's what I want to bring back, and that's what I want to show people that they can do in their home, and that you can have this more wholesome, connected experience with your food and feel really good doing it.
Cool.
When can I come?
that's the big question. So we're in the middle of construction. We've got a lot of work to do on the space, but we're actually having our first pop-up tonic bar. Our friends at Superior Merchandise and Troy are going to host us for next Troy Night Out, which is actually the night before the New York City Fermentation Festival.
Right on.
So we're going to start getting out there with some tonics and some fermented foods and sharing them with people. And then hopefully by April, we'll start some soft opening events. And by May, we hope to be there ready for you to come fill up your growler with tepache.
Fantastic. That's my next question is about that. These are generally lighter in alcohol and there's less preservatives. You don't want to be sitting on them for too long. Mm-hmm. What kind of size batches do you think you're going to start with for certain tonics like tepache?
Yeah, so I'm working on... With some things, it's a little bit easier. Like kombucha can chill out in bottles or in a keg for a week or two refrigerated and not get super alcoholic. Other mm-hmm. things really need to be served fresh in the moment. I'm working on scaling everything up by scaling up, I mean like from a 1 gallon batch to a 5 gallon batch.
Right.
And then just in everything, in the yogurt making, in the sauerkraut making, in all the different fermented foods that we're going to be making as well, I'm just going to start off with still relatively small batches. I've been to some microbreweries. I'm like, wow, those are like huge fermentation. All right. We're like, are we going to be like a nano brew or like a pico brew? Like, what is it? Like how small, like, what does it mean when you're doing a 5 gallon batch of something and serving it out of a barrel? I don't know. But so we're going to start small and see what people dig. And if mm-hmm. people want to take growlers of tepache home real bad, or if they're stoked on the maple water kefir, or if they are all about the kombucha or the yogurt or whatever, then we'll work on making more of it in a way that still holds true to the use of materials that we want to stick to. So I'm not trying to work up to using 55-gallon food-grade plastic barrels for, you know what I mean? So as much as I can find creative ways to make more to share with the community while still using traditional vessels, I'm going to mm-hmm. do that. And it's possible because it's been done. I mean,
right.
I was looking at winemaking in clay, and we're not going to be making alcoholic beverages to start off, at least for sure. But I've seen in the country of Georgia, I can't remember the name of the vessel, but they have these clay winemaking fermentation.
They're like big
vessels.
Amphoras, basically, right?
Right, exactly.
Amphorae, I don't know, is that might be the plural.
Massive, like easily some of them could be 2,000 liters, which is like 500 gallons. And the artisanship, I mean, it blows my mind is being blown right now just thinking about it again, like the potters that can make this big of a pot, and then the way that they build it into their space to where those pots are built into the ground so
right.
that they can stand above them. And we went to South River Miso quite a few months ago and seeing the big wooden vats that they make the miso in, and it's like, all right, you can do this. You can make things using natural materials, traditional materials in the traditional way, and make a lot of it if people are stoked about it, and they want to support what you're doing and support the ethic behind what you're doing, then there's solutions. So we're just going to work on those solutions as we need to, as they come up.
Mm-hmm. Cool. So if people want to, are you guys posting on a website or social media or anything, your
right.
progress? How
yeah.
how can people find more about
it? Right. So we're on Instagram now. We're going to be trying to regularly share the exciting things that we're up to, which the handle is Hello Tonico. So Tonico is just spelled like tonic with an O, T-O-N-I-C-O. So Hello Tonico, and we're on Facebook too, and the website is tonicotroy.com, and as we start getting farther along and sharing more, you'll be able to keep up with what we're doing there.
And keep up with you and other fermentation, your book, you have atomylab.com.
Yeah, atomylab.com is my.
And it is a wonderful
website.
Book, by the way. Obviously, yeah, we have a gorgeous. Lot of fermentation books. But yeah,
you.
I love it because it has, well, first of all, it has a lot of ferments, like a wide variety of ferments. Also, your introduction is really good. You have like break up the different types of ferments. Also, it's beautifully photographed. So you have like really good photographs that go along that help people, especially with less experience, but also that you have the basics, everything from like yogurt and water kefir to things like the fermented teas.
Right.
So it's a really nice, diverse book. I would highly recommend it.
Adam, thank you so much for joining us.
And
when you're driving back to Troy?
We're going to have some lunch here at Roberta's and then head back, I think. Yeah. So, sometime this afternoon.
Well, yeah. Thank you so much. And we're really, really excited to see you at the New York City Fermentation Festival as well. And we're really glad that you can bless us for that.
Which is February 24th.
February 25th.
25th, right.
NYCFermentationFestival.com.
Thank you all for having me. And yeah, I look forward to seeing you soon.
Cheers.
Ferment about it.
Ferment about it.
Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content and to hear about exclusive events, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at heritage_radio. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Rate the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join our community by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening.